Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Diller, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland City Council yesterday made an historic move to fund affordable housing using urban renewal money. We continue with our series about Amnesty International, which holds its national convention in Portland this weekend, and an investigation by the European Union finds the CIA has kidnapped people from around the world and tortured them in Europe.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,392 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,100 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 38,661 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. And in 2004, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion.
Meanwhile, President Bush's approval rating sank this week to 32%, a new low, according to CNN.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, April 27th, 2006. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra with my radio dog, Cosmo.
And I'm Marlise with no radio dog. The administrator of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission resigned today after being arrested for drunk driving. The police officer was stopped Saturday night near Portland's Ross Island Bridge. Her blood alcohol level was not immediately available. She's a graduate of Portland's Lewis and Clark Law School and worked as an attorney for 7 years, as well as in liquor enforcement in Colorado and Washington. She was an OLCC from 1981 to 1982. During Kaiser's tenure at the Liquor Control Agency, the OLCC began a 2-year pilot program to allow sales of distilled spirits in separate liquors with supermarkets instead of in traditional state-run outlets. So far, the pilot program has brought in more revenue than expected, the agency has said, but the pilot program has upset some existing liquor agents who say it will create unfair competition.
Corvallis Police Lieutenant Ron Noble, the department spokesman after the abduction of Brooke Wilberger, has been named police chief in McMinnville. Noble succeeds Wayne McFarlane, who resigned last November and has accused McMinnville Mayor Ed Gormley, of forcing him to quit under false pretenses, according to the McMinnville News Register. City officials said Noble must undergo a psychological evaluation, and Noble said he is still negotiating his salary and benefits. Noble has served the Corvallis Police Department for some 18 years. In 2004, after the disappearance of Wilberger, a 19-year-old Brigham Young student, Noble was spokesman for the department for a case that gained national media attention. Noble said this week that media reports generated roughly 5,000 tips in the case.
An historic vote yesterday at the Portland City Council puts urban renewal funds toward affordable housing projects. While many details still need to be worked out, housing advocates say this is a huge victory. KBOO programmer and Housing Now! Coalition activist Michael Anderson explains.
Following the leadership of Commissioners Eric Sten and Sam Adams, the City Council passed a historic resolution that would create a set-aside of urban renewal money dedicated to affordable housing. As we all know, we see in the headlines about how urban renewal money by the Portland Development high-end condos and other more glitzy projects like the tram. But what we were successful in doing yesterday with a unanimous vote at council is getting a policy change that, as we work out the details of the next 4 months, will follow the lead of California and create a set-aside to ensure funding for housing for regular working people, for seniors, and people with disabilities is set aside and dedicated to meeting their housing needs. There's a lot of reasons why it's taken so long to get a set aside like this, But the simplest terms are that when it comes to affordable housing, when it goes toe-to-toe with other big money development projects, affordable housing loses again and again. But with this particular city council, again, thanks to the leadership of Commissioner Sten and Commissioner Sam Adams, there's the political will to say, let's make affordable housing a priority. Let's be serious about addressing the needs of the less fortunate in our community. To get a set aside for tax increment financing has been a primary goal of the Affordable Housing Now Coalition, which is made up of over 40 organizations and hundreds of individuals that are brought together to fight for resources to meet the housing needs of our community. And we were told that this was a real long shot. We've been working on this for about 4 years, and we are very excited to have had this big step forward in the right direction.
That was KBOO programmer and Housing Now Coalition organizer Michael Anderson.
Timber companies in coastal counties are facing a logging shortfall from a harvest strategy adopted in 2001 for the Tillamook and Clatsop state forests. The strategy was sold to the public 5 years ago as a balanced approach that would provide for wildlife while now plenty of logs. But early actions turned out to be inflated. A review completed by the Oregon Department of Forestry confirmed a shortfall. That will mean cuts in revenue for coastal counties, meaning a loss of millions of dollars from the logging industry. Now the counties are pushing for more intensive logging on state forests, but such an increase would eat away habitat for wildlife that use the big, older trees. The Oregon Board of Forestry now faces a tough choice. Stick with the 2001 strategy or promote more logging by relaxing or ending wildlife strategies.
The U.S. Forest Service says the parts of the national forest that the Bush administration wants to sell are isolated, expensive to manage, and no longer needed. But an environmental group here in Oregon found the Forest Service has no documents to support its position. The Bush administration wants to sell more than 300,000 acres of national forest across the country to help pay for some of the nation's rural schools during the next 5 years. A bill is pending in Congress, but lawmakers from both parties argue the loss of public lands is not worth the short-term gain for schools. An Oregon environmental group filed a Freedom of Information request to find any supporting documents, but the Forest Service said it does not have any cost analysis of the land parcels. Eduardo?
Oregon and nine other states have filed suit against the Environmental Protection Agency over its decision not to regulate carbon dioxide pollution as a contributor to global warming. In addition to Oregon, New York, California, Connecticut, Maine, Massachusetts, New Mexico, Rhode Island, Vermont, and Wisconsin, they all filed a lawsuit in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. The states want the government to require tighter pollution control generation of power plants. Also joining the lawsuit are the cities of Washington and New York, as well as the Environmental Defense, Natural Resource Defense Council, and Sierra Club.
This weekend, Amnesty International USA hosts its annual conference on human rights in Portland. In anticipation of this event, the KBOO Evening News this week introduces you to the human rights defenders and abuse survivors working locally in Portland. One of the largest clinics for the treatment of torture victims is located here in Portland at the Oregon Health Sciences University. KBOO's Stephanie Potter spoke with Dr. David Kinsey, founder and director of the program. He will be speaking at the Amnesty International Conference this weekend.
In 1976, Dr. David Kinsey joined OHSU's psychiatry department, where he founded a program to treat Southeast Asian refugees suffering from war trauma.
I've been doing this work for 30 years, since the Vietnam War ended. We first got the Vietnamese refugees and then the Cambodian refugees. So we have a large clinic for refugees. Probably half have been under severe trauma or torture. We have 1,200 patients now from, I think we can accommodate 15 language groups.
The program became known as the Intercultural Psychiatric Program, or IPP. In 2000, Dr. Kinsey received funding to focus specifically on patients who have been tortured by agents of government, and the Torture Treatment Center was launched. Other patients who do not meet the strict federal criteria for torture are still treated at OHSU's IPP. Kinsey emphasized that torture victims come from all over.
Bosnia, ethnic cleansing, Somalia, which is a total breakdown in government, Ethiopia, We got people from Congo, from Sierra Leone. So still some people from Guatemala suffering defects. So it's a worldwide phenomenon.
And U.S. participation is no exception.
What is so currently disturbing is that Americans are doing it. We always knew other people were bad. We were good. And now we find we're just like everybody else. We do it too.
Citing Guantanamo, he questioned its usefulness and criticized the suspension of court trials.
Bush and his administration played the 9/11 Trump card of fear pretty strongly. And so the civil rights of people have been compromised a great deal. To me, the most cynical thing is when the administration says, we're going to bring people to justice, and yet deny them justice.
Kinsey also had sharp comments on U.S. definitions of torture.
The government often is used a definition of torture, which is not anywhere near the United Nations criteria for torture. You know, some things are not torture, they're inconvenient, like having to stand for 8 hours. I think Rumsfeld even said, I stand for 8 hours, what's the big deal? The point is that you're detained, you lose your rights, you're probably deprived of food, and you're under constant threat of more pain, more suffering, and more, certainly more humiliation.
He insisted that torture has no place in gathering information.
There's no rational purpose. There's no way you're going to get meaningful information if they had it. And you're going to get information, but it, just to stop the pain. So it's not a rational thing. It's just vengeance or just sadism.
And the psyche is left permanently scarred.
People will have symptoms for years, if not a lifetime. We know that from the Holocaust studies. We know it now from Cambodian studies. People have symptoms, nightmares, poor sleep, irritability, social isolation, for the lifetime if they're not treated. And you're inflicting a permanent sentence on people when you start the torture.
The good news is that the methods invoked by Dr. Kinsey and his staff can help.
We can really alleviate symptoms moderately fast. Some of the things are long-term personality changes and irritability and poor concentration take a long time. But some of the symptoms, nightmares and intrusive thoughts, we can really help pretty fast. So there's hope.
Kinsey added that pretty fast means a couple of months, and he said that refugees find out about his program through other refugees.
In the refugee community, we're known. Most of our patients come from our current patients who tell other patients, you know, I came, I got help, I feel better. So we have a lot of referrals from patients.
More remains to be done.
We got a large number of patients, but we know we're not treating very many people, relative percentage-wise.
Kinsey pointed out that the refugees are grateful just to be listened to and treated with respect, and he finds his work very gratifying.
Treating them has been very rewarding.
And his solution to the worldwide problem of torture? Simple.
Stop war. Violence just begets more violence at an international level and at a personal level. You know, people who start these wars don't have any idea the consequences of them and then how it just increases the amount of violence. And, you know, we see it unleashed now in Iraq, Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds are fighting. And when you get into a war situation and emotions run high and your friends get killed, a lot of people just retaliate indiscriminately.
Dr. Kinsey will be one of the speakers at Amnesty International's general meeting, which will be taking place here in Portland starting Friday the 28th. I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
This Friday at 4 p.m., Amnesty International hosts a rally at Pioneer Square to denounce torture. To hear more from our series on local human rights activists, visit the KBOO News Archives at www.kboo.fm.
This Saturday night, tens of thousands of teenagers from around the nation plan a unique demonstration designed to help bring an end to the war in Uganda. It's called the Global Night Commute. And here live in KBOO Studio 2, we have the organizers, Chris Cargill and Andrew Park. Chris, Andrew, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
This is a profound story, so let's start out by asking you, how did you get involved in the Ugandan Civil War?
Well, for me, it was very simple. I was just about to graduate college, and they showed the film at my church, and I saw what was happening with these kids, that first they were being abducted and forced to do the most horrendous things, and then even the ones that weren't abducted were just subjected to such a horrible life, that I wanted to do something, I wanted to do anything, and I had the opportunity. They offered me to become a part of the story and to travel around the country showing this film at universities and high schools and everywhere, and so I just jumped at it.
Yeah, when I was in college, my roommate about a year ago, he was really good friends with one of the filmmakers of Invisible Children, and he showed it at our house, and I was forever changed, and I said, I have to do something. It's not like a question of, I should do something, but you can't help but not do something.
And but this film, somehow the journey became a film, and we already talked about that. So now the film was not enough. So now let's tell the listeners about how the global night commute, about the global night commute and what's happening Saturday night.
Well, sure. The film, just in case anybody hasn't seen it, is just to briefly cover it, is about children in northern Uganda that they're being threatened with abduction by a rebel army, and they're forced to become child soldiers. So in order to avoid that, they walk miles every day and every morning to city centers where they sleep by the thousands in often unsupervised areas where they're not being fed. They're just crowded together, and this is their lives. And so what we wanted to do, as Drew was saying, when this was captured on film by three young guys from Southern California, they brought it back here and they showed it to people. And what people continued to say was, this is horrible. We have to do something. And so what we wanted to do was do something practical, not just raising money and not just building safety for them, but we want to end the war. And in order to do that, we seriously believe that we have to raise awareness. We've talked to a lot of people in Washington, D.C. As a matter of fact, we have two U.S. senators doing the night commute with us this weekend. And they have said that if we can bring the people out into the streets this weekend, then they will do everything within their power to end the war in Uganda. And so that's what we need to do. We need to crowd the streets with people that are going to be sleeping. Well, not crowd the streets. We're going to be doing it in an organized fashion. We want to work peacefully as much with the government as possible to show them that it's a meaningful, it's a manageable solution. And so that's what we're doing. There's going to be, we have around 40,000 people signed up on the website. We're expecting 50 to maybe even 75,000 people showing up that night. And we just quite simply want to end the war.
Let me quickly ask you, Invisible Children, the title really hits me. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the filmmakers, when they went over there, they saw these children and they said to themselves, why have we never heard of this before? Why is this? This doesn't make any sense. It's been going on for such a long time. And they said, these children are invisible. These children have no voice and it's not seen and it's not heard. And so it just keeps happening. And over anywhere between 30,000 to 50,000 kids have been abducted over a 20-year period during the Civil War. So they thought that was kind of a very appropriate name for them.
Now, tell us one more time where people can see the film and how they can hook up with Global Night Commute.
Well, they can see the film tonight at 10 o'clock at the Mission Theater in Portland. We're going to have a screening of the film and then a gathering afterwards. And if they want to sign up for the Global Night Commute,
they can sign up online at invisiblechildren.com.
And who's the film director, by the way?
It was directed by three guys from Southern California just out of film school. It was Laren Poole, Bobby Bailey, and Jason Russell. And if you want to find out any more information, you can go to www.invisiblechildren.com. We've got a fantastic website. And if you're of the sort and you're looking for a few new friends, we've got about 150 pages on MySpace as well.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks again, Andrew. Invisible Children airs tonight at the Portland Mission Theater at 10 p.m. And for more information on the Global Night Commute, you can go to www.invisiblechildren.com. Marlies.
Raids on fishing boats at the mouth of the Columbia River led to more than a dozen immigration arrests yesterday. Federal agents joined Washington state agencies to search ships at the Port of Chinook and at Bell Buoy Crab Co. in Chinook, Washington. In addition to the shipboard arrests, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers arrested six women, nine men, and a boy for being in the country illegally. They were transported to Portland and will be deported, officials said. The warrants were issued as part of an investigation into possible violations of fishing report requirements. Eduardo?
7 of 18 California counties who were sued by activists to prevent them from using Diebold Election Systems electronic voting machines last November's election were removed from the lawsuit after agreeing to use paper ballots instead. The suit was filed by voteraction.org on behalf of 25 California voters. The seven counties that switched to paper ballots are Humboldt, Marin, Placer, San Luis Obispo, Trinity, Tulare, and the Santa Barbara counties. They were dropped from the suit yesterday after giving assurances to a judge they would use the paper ballots. The suit also names California, which this year approved the use of the disputed voting machine which is built by Diebold Election Systems. The lawsuit alleges that the touchscreen voting machines lack adequate security and aren't easily used by the disabled. The company, though, stands by its machines. The suit now names the counties of Alameda, Fresno, Kern, Lassen, Los Angeles, Mendocino, Modoc, Plumas, San Diego, San Joaquin, and Siskiyou.
A federal prosecutor today challenged Enron founder Kenneth Lay's testimony that short sellers were partly to blame for the company's collapse in 2001 by showing that Lay's own son bet Enron's stock would drop. Selling stock short is essentially betting the price will drop. Short sellers borrow stock to sell on the market and buy back at a lower price, pocketing the profit. Lay and former Enron chief executive Jeffrey Skilling contend that short sellers had mounted a concerted attack on Enron stock that year that helped drive it into bankruptcy protection. On the second day of Lay's cross-examination at his fraud trial, prosecutor John Houston played a tape of Lay telling Enron employees in October 2001 that Enron was under attack, quote, just like America's under attack by terrorism, end quote.
The six retired generals who have called for Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's resignation may soon get a chance to bring their complaints to Capitol Hill. In response to a request from Senator Hillary Clinton, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator John Warner, a Republican from Virginia, said he would ask his committee to vote on whether to hold a hearing with all of the six generals. The hearing would give critics of the embattled Defense Secretary a high-profile forum to air their grievances about Rumsfeld's management of the Iraq War. A vote in favor of holding such a hearing is a distinct possibility. All 11 Democrats on the committee can be expected to vote yes, which means it would take only two of the committee's 13 Republicans to make it happen. Two Republicans on the committee, Senator Susan Collins of Maine and Senator John McCain, have been among Rumsfeld's toughest critics. Neither said how they will vote.
In Congress today, Senate Republicans advocated sending $100 rebate checks to millions of taxpayers to overcome bad public opinion on spiking gas prices. In addition, a Democrat is leading a campaign for a 60-day gasoline tax holiday. Either way, it seems no one in Congress wants to be without a plan, however symbolic, to attack the election year crisis at the pump. A vote is possible as early as this week on the Senate GOP approach. It calls for $100 rebate checks for taxpayers to cushion the impact of higher gasoline prices. The measure seems unlikely to prevail, at least initially, because it includes a highly controversial proposal to open a portion of Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Democrats seemed caught off guard by the GOP maneuvering, but a spokesman said they would have a plan of their own.
ExxonMobil, which is the largest oil company, said today higher oil prices drove first quarter profit up 7% from the prior year. Net income rose to $8.4 billion. That's a 7% rise from last year's earnings. The report comes amid consumer outcry in the U.S. about soaring gasoline prices. The average retail price of gasoline in the U.S. is now $2.91 a gallon, or 68 cents higher than a year ago. In January, ExxonMobil posted the highest quarterly and annual profits of any U.S. company in history, $10.71 billion for the fourth quarter of 2005 and $36.13 billion for the full year.
Leaders of the big three U.S. automakers plan to meet with President Bush at the White House next month to discuss issues faced by the industry, officials say today. Bush will meet with Ford Chairman and CEO Bill Ford, General Motors Corporation Chairman and Chief Executive Rick Wagoner, and Chrysler Group President and CEO Tom Lasorda in their first joint meeting with the president during the Bush administration. Ford spokesman Josh Gottheimer confirmed plans for the meeting, calling it, quote, a continuation of a constructive conversation with the White House, unquote. Officials with GM and Daimler Chrysler AG declined comment. Officials helping plan the meeting expected it to involve discussions of environmental and energy concerns, including ways of expanding the availability of ethanol, along with health care and pension costs faced by the industry and currency issues. Eduardo?
The state of California is taking in more money in income taxes than expected. With two more days to count returns, embattled Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says the state has collected $1.5 billion more in income taxes than it was anticipating for the month of April. Some lawmakers say they will call for the state to use the extra money to boost funding for public schools and aid to the disabled. A Department of Finance spokesman says the higher numbers reflect improvements, so-called improvements, in the state's economy, but warned the state must first pay off debts and guard against lawsuits.
A Senate committee is in impasse over legislation on the NSA spying program. Democrats opposed going forward on three proposed bills, saying information on the proposals is inadequate, while committee chair Arlene Specter said he'll introduce legislation that would stop funding the NSA. Meanwhile, the House passed an intelligence bill that critics say expands executive powers. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more.
Civil liberties groups and those critical of the president's NSA spying program have been saying that legislation is futile if the details of the program are not yet known. Democrats took that position and opposed the passage of draftation out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
To pass legislation now is like a doctor diagnosing a patient without seeing the patient or seeing the records of the patient. And I'm strongly opposed to it.
The American Civil Liberties Union applauds Democratic efforts to halt the legislation. Caroline Fredrickson is with the ACLU.
Senator Feinstein from California could not have framed it more accurately. So we think they should investigate before they legislate.
Senator Feinstein is a member of the Select Intelligence Committee receiving briefings on the NSA program by the administration. She is dissatisfied with the information she has received so far. But Republican Orrin Hatch from Utah, also a member of the Select Committee, says he is pleased and he believes the program is lawful.
Anybody who can think this through at all knows that the current FISA language will not take care of allowing Congress and the courts to do what Congress and the courts, generally would like to do.
The president defends the program by saying he has inherent powers to authorize it. Critics say it could be unconstitutional and that the courts of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act should not be bypassed. The three bills proposed in the Judiciary Committee so far include one that would allow the FISA courts to determine the need for the program. The second would provide Congress with more oversight, and the third would put it on a fast track to the Supreme Court for them to decide the constitutionality. Judiciary Committee Chair Arlen Specter is deeply concerned with the expansion of presidential powers and the administration's disregard for congressional authority. He doesn't understand the lack of outrage over the program.
You have as important a consideration on national security and fighting terrorism contrasted with civil liberties as I have seen. Historically, I can't think of a more important confrontation that this country has faced.
To test people's complacency, he plans to introduce an amendment that would stop all funding for the NSA. Ranking Member Patrick Heath from Vermont has been calling for a subpoena of administration officials with knowledge of the program to testify. But Senator Specter says it won't do any good because they won't answer any questions. Meanwhile, the House overwhelmingly passed an intelligence authorization bill that will set funding and policy initiatives for the intelligence agencies. House Select Intelligence Committee Chair Peter Hoekstra from Michigan.
We want an intelligence community that is more than one step faster than the former Soviet Union. We want one that is going to be effective against the targets we face today, the targets that we face in the near term, and the targets that we are going to face in the long term. This is another successful building block in getting us to that goal.
Critics oppose the bill because provisions were rejected that would provide congressional oversight of the NSA spying program. Jane Harman, ranking member of the Intelligence Committee, who was also briefed by the administration on the NSA spying program, said she voted against this annual bill for the first time in 12 years because it fails to check the president's expanded powers. The legislation also dissuades intelligence employees from leaking information to the press by threatening to take away their pensions and imposing other repercussions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A federal jury in Manhattan began deliberations this morning in the perjury trial of a San Diego man who knew two of the September 11th terrorists. 25-year-old Osama Adwala came from Jordan to attend college in San Diego. He met the hijackers at a local mosque, it is alleged. Adwala is accused of lying to a grand jury about how well he knew one of the organizers, Khalid al-Mihyar. Adwala revised his grand jury testimony just after 5 days after his appearance in October 2001. Prosecutors argued his initial evasiveness may have hindered investigations. The federal district court judge overseeing the case says if Adwala is convicted, he will likely face deportation but avoid jail time. And in another story, a U.S. Army paratrooper pleaded guilty today to engaging in sex acts on a military-themed gay pornographic website after a judge denied a request to dismiss the case. Private First Class Richard T. Ashley, one of the seven members of the 82nd Airborne Division who is charged with appearing on the site, faces up to a year in prison. Forfeiture of two-thirds of his pay for 1 year and a reduction in rank and a bad conduct discharge. Ashley, along with Private First Class Wesley K. Mitten and Private Kagan B. Mullen, were charged with pandering, sodomy, and wrongfully engaging in sexual acts over the internet for money. Mitten and Mullen, who also faces adultery charges, have pleaded not guilty. The 15,000 U.S. paratroopers of the 82nd Airborne are among the Army's elite soldiers, having volunteered to serve in a unit that trains to deploy anywhere in the world within 18 hours. The military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy states that homosexual orientation alone is not a bar to service, but homosexual conduct is compatible with military service.
18 anti-war activists who call themselves the Granny Peace Brigade were acquitted today of disorderly conduct charges stemming from a protest outside a Times Square military recruiting center last fall. Judge Neil Ross said his verdict following a 7-day bench trial was not a commentary on any police action that day. The packed courtroom erupted into applause after Ross said the prosecution failed to prove each defendant guilty of each charge. If convicted, each would have faced up to 15 days in prison. They are great Americans, and they walk the shoes of great Americans who have made America the place that it is, he said. The defendants, including several in their 80s and 90s, had been charged with two counts of disorderly conduct in the October 17, 2005 protest against the war in Iraq.
Five high school students in Maryland were suspended after staging a die-in in front of a U.S. Marine Corps recruiting booth during an on-campus job fair, one of the students said. Bob Hayes, who is a junior at Governor Thompson Johnson High School, said he and four other students fell down in front of the booth, then passed out leaflets protesting the war in Iraq and the presence of U.S. military recruiter on their school grounds. A sheriff's deputy took the two students away after they refused to move during their demonstration, Hayes said. And three other students willingly and uh, three other students Three others went willingly and were kept in the principal's office for about 3 hours, he said. A school official confirmed that the five students were disciplined last Wednesday for distributing unapproved leaflets and partially blocking access to an adjacent booth. "We do not suspend kids for protesting if they do it in the right way," said Hank Bolander, and he's an associate superintendent of Frederick County Public Schools.
And the head of California school system is urging students to stay in school during protests against proposals to change the nation's immigration laws. Jack O'Connell, state superintendent for public instruction, spoke at a school in San Jose today. He encouraged students to voice their opinion, but to do so after school. He also warned that schools will take action against students who skip school in protest, including protests planned for May 1st.
Foreign correspondent Emily Harris, currently on leave from National Public Radio, appears in Portland this weekend to benefit young musicians and artists. Emily made her start in radio with the KBOO News Department. We spoke with her earlier today on her work reporting from Iraq.
Do you feel that there are stories, and looking at our war effort there in Iraq and Afghanistan too, do you feel that there are stories that should be getting out that are not?
I definitely think in Afghanistan, the number of reporters from the United States there has dropped so dramatically after the U.S. invasion of Iraq that I don't know what stories aren't getting out of Afghanistan, but I know for sure there aren't enough American reporters there looking at what's going on. In Iraq, again, I can't say what stories aren't getting out, but in general, I actually feel that reporters there, with a lot of help from their Iraqi colleagues, many of them which have worked for these organizations for 2 or 3 years now, are doing a pretty good job of getting a range of stories out there. I think that, of course, the easy story to do, which is done regularly, and is an important one to do, is keeping track of the number of car bombs that go off, the number of American soldiers that die. A lot of people tell me they hear that and they tune it out because they just feel like it's the same old stuff. But it is an important daily event in a country where the United States is spending billions of dollars. As far as other stories, I mean, there's a lot of stories that are hard to do there, that are also hard to do anywhere, but certainly understanding the insurgency is not only hard to do, but dangerous. Getting a hold on the level of corruption there is also very difficult to do, but there are stories out there that have made real progress in getting that picture across. So I think there's actually a lot of good reporting coming out of Iraq in pretty difficult circumstances.
When you do go to dinner parties, what is the most common question people ask you?
A lot of them ask me if I know Sylvia Pagioli, who is our who is our correspondent in Rome and has the most popular name on NPR. And I do know Sylvia, and she's lovely to work with. But when you get to more serious things like Iraq, people, a lot of people want a prediction for what's going to happen there. When will the U.S. get troops out? Is there a chance that, really a democracy there? And I'm not very good at predicting the future at all. I mean, it's clear that there's a whole lot of challenges, not only, let alone a democracy, but for a stable government in Iraq. I mean, challenges, there's obviously the daily insurgency, the fighting, the danger, the infrastructure is still a wreck. The whole question of who is going to control the oil revenues and how that will be distributed, not just among ethnic groups in Iraq, within Iraq, ethnic or religious groups, but also just how much of that is going to come down to the ordinary population level. Those are enormous questions facing the country, and the answers to those are going to be are going to make a big difference in terms of whether this will be a stable government or not. And of course, there's a lot of outside regional influences. The United States, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, all are very interested and involved in what's going on there. So it's not just like letting Iraq go where it will by itself.
And that was former KBOO News volunteer Emily Harris, now an NPR foreign correspondent. And she speaks in Portland Saturday, April 29th at 7:30 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church on Southwest 12th and Salmon. And tickets are available through Young Musicians and Artists. For information, call 503-281-9528 or go to www.yminc.org. And for the full interview with Emily Harris, you can go to our website, www.kboo.org.
The current time is 5:39, and now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Look out! Here comes Halliburton again. With his own personal sugar daddy occupying the vice president's chair, this giant government contractor keeps getting multi-billion dollar no-bid contracts from the Bush-Cheney regime, despite having been found guilty of shoddy work, massive cost overruns, and fraudulent billings. His latest windfall, however, should not merely be worrisome to taxpayers, but also to anyone concerned about the Bushites' anti-democratic penchant to extend ever more police and military power over we the people. Halliburton has been granted a $385 million contract for a most unusual project, building a network of detention centers across our country. Up to 5,000 people could be detained and held in each of these centers, which are to be run by Homeland Security authorities and possibly located on unused military bases. Detain, of course, is a euphemism for incarcerate or lock up, and center is a gentle term for prison. So, why does America suddenly need to spend a third of $1 billion to establish a new mass prison complex in our country? The feds and Halliburton cryptically say that the detention centers could be needed for, quote, some kind of mass migration, or for, quote, the rapid development of new programs. When asked what is meant by the ominous term, new programs, a Halliburton spokeswoman said she could provide no additional information. Another curious aspect is that the Bushites refer to this as a contingency contract, saying that the detention centers might never be built, but that Halliburton will have the cash and authority to move quickly, even when given the go-ahead. The corporation's executive vice president says that Halliburton is gratified because the deal, quote, builds on our extremely strong track record in the arena of emergency management support. This is Jim Hightower saying, but who is to be managed and in support of what policy? Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
For independent Native news following our newscast tonight at 6 p.m. Hear Proverbial Perspectives with Bruce Broussard. And tonight he hosts a wide-ranging candidates forum. At 7, of course, it's Good Times with the swinging and swanky Reggae Bob. And tonight's weather, sort of nice. In the Willamette Valley, cloudy and warm, and the same for the Columbia Gorge. And tomorrow, very nice again. In Portland, Corvallis, for example, sunny and 75 degrees. And in Hood River, some clouds, but nicely warm with highs over 70 degrees. You are listening to the KBOO Handcrafted Evening News for Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
An investigation by European Union parliamentarians has concluded that European territory was used by the CIA for the practice of so-called, quote, extraordinary rendition, end quote. Their report says that the CIA is guilty of kidnapping and illegal detention of terrorist suspects. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
An investigation by European Union parliamentarians has concluded that European territory was used by the CIA for the practice of so-called extraordinary rendition. Their report says that the CIA is guilty of kidnapping and illegal abduction of terrorist suspects. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
European parliamentarians who've investigated the practice of extraordinary rendition have not just confirmed that more than 1,000 secret flights operated over EU territory in the last 5 years. They're also suggesting that some European governments knew about the flights. But Britain's Foreign Secretary Jack Straw still maintains there's no material evidence to prove that the US used British airspace for that purpose. Member of the European Parliament Sarah Ludford was involved in the European Union investigation.
Certainly if there have been breaches of international law, then we would expect the police and the judicial authorities of the member states to take an interest. There's a great deal of both parliamentary and judicial interest across the EU. It's an opportunity for parliamentary and human rights Europe, civil society Europe, to pull together and to call our governments to account for anything that they might have done.
The European Parliament now has to decide what other steps and possible sanctions should be taken. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
A sister of Iraq's new Sunni Arab vice president was killed today in a drive-by shooting in Baghdad a day after the politician called for the Sunni-dominated rebellion to be crushed by force. In southern Iraq, a bomb hit an Italian military convoy, killing 4 soldiers, 3 Italians and a Romanian, and seriously injuring another passenger, officials in Rome said. The bomb struck the convoy near an Italian military base in Nasiriyah, a heavily Shiite city about 200 miles southeast of Baghdad. And elsewhere, a U.S. plane fired 2 missiles at rebel positions in Ramadi. Fighting also broke out northeast of Baghdad between Iraqi forces and rebels. The violence came as Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld were visiting Baghdad to meet with officials in the new Iraqi government. Nuri al-Maliki, that is, a Shiite hardliner, recently tapped as Iraq's prime minister, is trying to form a national unity government aimed at stopping a wave of sectarian violence. Al-Maliki has 30 days to assemble a cabinet from divided Shiite, Sunni, and Kurdish parties. The most contentious question there will be filling key ministries that control security forces amid demands to purge them of militias blamed for the rise in sectarian bloodshed.
The Iraqi Ministry of Education reports that between October of last year and the end of February, 400 teachers and employees from the ministry have been killed, 170 have been wounded, and that 417 schools have been attacked. Some were shut down. David Enders reports this from Baghdad.
Students file back to class after recess at Dijla Elementary School in Mansour on Baghdad's west side. In October, the school was hit by a mortar round, killing 1 student and injuring 10. The school has kept the classroom the mortar struck closed since then because, the principal says, the students are too afraid to go back into the classroom. Many students have left the school because their parents keep them home or have left the country. 11-year-old Amin Khaldun was in the classroom when the mortar hit.
My parents gave me the choice to quit school because of the situation. I insisted to continue because I am a good student. We want to live in peace like American students and to have the right to our childhood.
In addition to the threat of violence, Iraq's school system, despite reconstruction efforts, remains in need of 4,500 new schools. Fala al-Qarashi, an assistant to the general director of the Ministry of Education, complains that money is being spent to hire guards rather than build new schools. But teachers complain that the guards aren't armed. Jalal Yassin Al-Nakesh is a teacher at Al-Mansour Teachers College, a specialized high school for students who want to teach. One of the school's buses was attacked on the way to school last month, killing the driver.
The Ministry of Education is not helping with the security situation. We have about 1,250 students in our institute, and the guards were not armed. We collected donations from our salaries to buy weapons for the security guards.
Nakash also says that inflation has finally caught up with teachers' salaries, which were raised from an average of $5 a month before the war to at least $100 per month afterward, a move cited as a great success by the Bush administration. Nakash, who has been teaching for more than 25 years, is in the top tier of salary earners, making about $330, or 500,000 dinar each month. He says he now spends 100,000 dinars each month on electricity from a generator shared by his neighborhood. Nakash says the quality of education for future teachers is also suffering as instructors try to accommodate students who miss school more often than before because of roadblocks and other daily traffic hassles, or because they have lost a family member or friend, as it increasingly seems everyone in Baghdad has.
Because of the security situation, we tried to facilitate things for the students. But if we were working on our regular system, at least 50% of the students probably would not have passed.
There have been reports of sectarian tensions entering schools, including fights between teachers and teachers from one sect giving bad marks to students of another. But most teachers interviewed said they were making a concerted effort to combat sectarian rhetoric and that education was the best weapon. But even the best efforts by teachers might not be enough. At Tariq bin Ziyad High School, Principal Rad Abdul-Jabbar says enrollment at his school has risen from 320 last year to 620 this year, as parents from around the neighborhood insist on sending their children to a school close by rather than one that requires busing. This trend is being repeated all over the city and exacerbated by the influx of displaced Shiites from Baghdad's suburbs. But Jabbar's greatest problem remains that so many of his students have been affected by Baghdad's rampant kidnappings, assassinations, and random deaths.
As a result, of course, they don't see why they are studying or preparing themselves for the future, as the future is very ambiguous now.
In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
Protests outside the annual meeting of the world's largest gold mining company, Newmont Mining, prompted company officials to meet with activists from around the world. Demonstrators gathered outside the Denver-based company to support community activists from Ghana, Peru, and Nevada, who accused Newmont of environmental devastation, water contamination, and the displacement of thousands of people. FSRN's Maeve Conran reports from Colorado.
Padre Marcos Arañas is one of the activists from communities affected by Newmont Mining who addressed the Newmont shareholders. Father Arañas from the Cajamarca region in northern Peru described the many problems in the community which are a direct result of Newmont's activities.
Newmont came onto our area about 13 years ago, and since then there have been problems related to the purchases of land. Many of the campesinos have been removed from their lands. Also, we have problems with pollution of the water and the rivers and lack of water available for the people.
Pollution of existing water sources and depletion of water tables are accusations offered at Newmont. Daniel Uso Corrente is from Accra in Ghana, where a new Newmont mine is contaminating water and displacing thousands of people with the dispensation. Corrente says a slick PR campaign levied at a largely uneducated community has clouded the fact that the number of mining jobs created won't replace the number of agricultural jobs which will be lost due to the mine's construction.
Normally, mining is located in areas of high literacy and poverty. And sometimes mining companies can take advantage of those things and try to manipulate the short-term amenities. And that is where the problem arises, because when communities are in the long term, the promises and hopes are shattered.
Newmont states that it's an economic and cultural right of indigenous people. The Western Shoshone in Nevada disagree. They accuse Newmont of disregarding their rights and colluding with the U.S. government belong to the Western Shoshone. Julie Fischel is an attorney with the Western Shoshone Defense Project.
One thing we specifically talked to Newmont about last year when we were here was that their efforts to privatize those lands was one of the biggest threats facing the Shoshone people, and that they needed to hold off on any further privatization efforts. And now we saw a huge push through Congressman Gibbons' office and Congressman Pombo's office to do exactly what we had talked to Newmont about not doing.
Following yesterday's peaceful protest outside the shareholders' meeting, Newmont CEO Wayne Murty met with the activists from Peru, Ghana, and Western Shoshone people to hear their concerns about Newmont's activities. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Denver.
If you have any questions or comments about what you just heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave us a message on extension 203, or you can send us an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening, of course, to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 8.7 FM on Translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on Translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is, of course, Lisa Loving. Tonight's audio editors are Josh Johnson and Sam Fletcher. Special thanks to reporters Stephanie Potter, Kirsten Flagg, and Rabia Lehman. Our engineer is Josh Johnson. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Eduardo de Landeros Tierra, along with my radio dog Cosmo.
Thanks, Eduardo and Cosmo. I'm Marlise Franklin. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And then join us tomorrow morning, bright and early at 7 o'clock a.m. Hear the KBOO Morning News. We'll follow that at 7:30 with Positively Revolting Talk Radio. Ani and Melody will discuss the Wiccan holiday of Beltane. They will also welcome local pet psychic Faye Petrikowski. She will welcome your calls about animals. At 9, it's the Friday Radio Zine, and Hunt Work of School of the Americas will talk about the state of the campaign to close the school and the upcoming Portland visit by Father Roy Bourgeois. At 9:30, Per Fagering interviews Michael Newman of Trent University about the Israel lobby and U.S. foreign policy, which is a controversial article published this month. And at 10, hear a lecture by Ruth Messinger of the American Jewish World Service. She'll be speaking on stopping genocide in Darfur. We'll also have an update on this weekend's rally to save Darfur. At 11 o'clock, as always, hear Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. I'd also like to invite you to listen in this coming Monday, May 1st. Your radio station, KBOO, along with many other community radio stations in the U.S. and Europe, will launch an entire day-long programming on human rights and immigrants from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Tune in to KBOO for live coverage of the marches, speeches, and debates in solidarity with No Latinos National Day, the nationwide strike and boycott to focus on human rights. That is all here for you at KBOO Profit, your volunteer-powered and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thank you for joining us. This is Independent Native News for Thursday, the 27th of April. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Canada's Minister of Indian Affairs recently underlined his support for the proposed Mackenzie Valley pipeline. Jim Prentice says the new Conservative government wants to see the gas pipeline built. Referring to the Decho First Nations, Prentice says the government isn't prepared to wait for every region to come out in support of the project.
At the end of the day, we are hoping that the Aboriginal communities of the North will be unanimous in supporting the project. We hope that unanimity is possible, but at the end of the day, we'll be searching for a route forward that is supported by the majority of the people in the North.
The Decho leadership doesn't support the pipeline, the Aboriginal Pipeline Group, or the environmental assessment now underway on the Mackenzie Gas Project. In other news, federal officials and representatives of Native American tribes from across the country are in Sitka, Alaska this week, attending the annual meeting of the Native American Lands Environmental Mitigation Program, or NALEMP. The program is a collaboration between 23 tribes, the Department of Defense, and the Army Corps of Engineers, addressing military contamination in Indian country. KCAW's Melissa Marconi-Wenzel reports.
This year marks the 10-year anniversary of NALEMP, and in honor of the milestone, the DOD is holding its annual meeting in Sitka, a city that could arguably be called the birthplace of the program. Sitka Tribe of Alaska NALEMP Coordinator Steve Johnson.
The initial legislation and the policy that gave birth to the program was initiated by staff members of Sitka Tribe of Alaska. So in a sense, they're back to the home ground.
Johnson says in his estimation the partnership is working very well. And he says the meeting is more than a chance to commemorate the anniversary. It's an invaluable opportunity for collaboration.
It's a chance for tribes across the nation to come together and to put our heads together and to think about where we want this program to go in the future, some of the accomplishments we've done in the past, and how do we best work with Department of Defense to serve the tribal citizens.
Serving tribal citizens means cleaning up decades of contamination left over from military activities. And in some cases, it means addressing the fact that many native lands seized by the military during World War II have never been returned. NALEMP receives a $10 million annual federal earmark, which Johnson says doesn't go very far, an issue that he says will be addressed at this year's meeting.
We as tribes have been considering and mulling around the possibility of seeking more permanent legislation, something beyond an earmark.
The annual meeting of the Native American Lands Environmental Mitigation Program will finish up on Thursday, April 27th. Reporting in Sitka, Alaska, I'm Alyssa Marconi-Wenzel.
Connecticut officials are scrutinizing an agreement that would put the MGM Grand name on a new hotel and casino at the Mashantucket Pequot's Foxwoods Resort. WSHU's Ebong Udama reports.
Connecticut Attorney General Richard Blumenthal says he's taking a close look at the deal because it might violate the state's compact with the Mashantucket Pequot tribe.
Under our compact, the tribe and only the tribe can own a casino indefinitely. Others may help manage it, but they have to be licensed and approved.
The Attorney General has sent a letter to the tribe requesting copies of the agreement and any agreement-related documents. The Mashantucket Pequot have contended that the agreement does not violate their compact with the state. Foxwoods Resort CEO Bill Sherlock says the tribe is leasing the name from MGM Mirage for the $700 million expansion of its casino.
The employees will still be Foxwoods employees. The management will still be Foxwoods management.
In the meantime, the tribe's lawyers are reviewing Blumenthal's letter. In Fairfield, Connecticut, I'm Ebong Udama.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976.
It's 6:02, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Proverbial Perspectives with Bruce Broussard.